In France, the movie we're about to talk about was called Weekend of Terror. In Germany, it was titled The Horror Party. It has quite a cult following and has been compared to the storyline of the Agatha Christie novel, And Then There Were None. It's a slasher unlike any other, with a distinct lack of on-screen violence. I personally remember going into my neighborhood video store and being drawn in by the awesome VHS cover. A woman has her back to the camera. Her ponytail is braided into a noose as she holds a dagger behind her back. That cover alone is a masterpiece. So join us as we visit Muffy St. John on her private island and see how the 1% live. It's time to celebrate April Fool's Day.
Paramount Pictures cordially invites you for a weekend getaway at the party to end all parties.
This is the craziest party that could ever be. Turn on lights, because I don't want to see.
April Fool, welcome to my home and lifestyles of the rich and undeserving.
Wrong.
Cheers.
Join eight privileged guests who are just dying to have fun.
Wow, what is this, the bridal suite? You like it?
The ladies.
I found a use for it.
The gentlemen.
We did, on the first date.
The young.
Well, basically, I possess an essential lack of seriousness.
And the restless.
You are such a jerk.
Everyone is having such a good time. It's scary.
Something wrong?
You're dead.
Radio is blasting. Someone's knocking at the door. I'm looking at my girl. She passed out.
Nikki!
I'll see someone in the hall. I'll never see you before. You know what it is? I don't want to see
you. April Fool's Day. Get ready to party till you drop.
Joining us for spring break are Ryan of the Social Distance Horror Club and the hosts of Bunk 237 Horror Movie Podcast, Tuyet and Robin. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Thanks so much for having us. I'm Tuyet. This is my voice. I live in LA and I do a horror podcast with my friend Robin.
That's me. I'm Robin. I used to live in LA until recently, moved to the East Coast. And but we're still going strong with the horror podcast despite the ridiculous time difference.
Robin moved to New England where it's spookier.
Yeah.
Ooh.
For the spookiness, not.
And how long have you been doing the podcast for?
We were just talking about this, like almost a year now. It was definitely a quarantine project.
Absolutely.
Very attached to.
I feel like there's a bit of a theme going on here with the, like, you know, starting things during the pandemic, because Ryan, I believe you started something also during the pandemic.
Absolutely. So I started the Social Distance Horror Club on Instagram as a way to filter through the gems versus the duds on various streaming platforms when it came to horror movies, basically because a lot of folks that I knew, if they were going to, you know, dip their toe into the horror pool, didn't really know what they were looking at sometimes. They knew the mainstream stuff, but not the lesser known. So yeah, labor of love that became more of a hobby than I expected. And I've been doing it for over a year now. We just hit a year. It's been a good time.
Nice. Excellent. Yeah. So we're going to start you off all with what we call the Scaredy Cat 5. So these are 5 questions that we ask every new guest, just to kind of get an idea of what you like in horror, what you don't like, that sort of thing. So to kick us off, why don't you tell us what your favorite subgenre of horror is?
Tuyet, Robin, why don't you go first on this one?
Well, I was trying to think, because I, as a horror fan, I love anything, everything. I'll watch everything. But I've been thinking about this recently, and I really love a haunted house. That's a haunted house, ghosts, even also demon possession. Mm-hmm. Kind of stories.
Yeah, I like monster movies, like zombies, vampires, like creature features, like things with some sort of kind of supernatural humanoid creature like Lurking in the Dark. I think those are the movies that I tend to go for the most.
For me, you know, it's kind of a toss up between body horror and real, like horror that could almost be taking place in real life. Not that I don't enjoy all the other subgenres that are out there, but oftentimes, like I was just watching The Ruins the other day, where it's not obviously very factual, but the concept of having, you know, sentient vines stuck in your body, like that sort of thing, just like you, things you want out of your body, like, or like movies like The Fly, things along those lines, just creep me right the hell out, very much so.
Yeah, I find body horror is generally what makes me the most squeamish, but
yes.
What is your least favorite subgenre of horror?
Don't really have one, but if I had to say something, I think that some of the more recent, like super slow burny atmospheric kind of horror films just kind of get bored sometimes, and I feel bad saying that because I'll still watch them and enjoy them, but sometimes I'm just like, all right, I get it.
Oh, I love a slow burn. I love a psychological slow burn with some sort of explosive kind of thing in the last 10 to 15 minutes. I love a horror movie that makes me wait.
I can get down with those, but the payoff's got to be good.
Right.
If there's no good payoff, and I'm just like, I just wasted 90 minutes. And I appreciate the work put into the movie, but then I'm just like, come on.
Right.
For me, you know, I had to think about this one because it's a hard call. There are very few found footage films that I really like, and there are a couple that do it really well. I love Hell House. Obviously, Blair Witch, like, nailed it. But the majority of them, it's found footage is my least favorite. I have found, you see the ones where it's a bunch of young adults, one of them's got a camera. Hey, introduce yourself to the camera for us. And they all go through, there's like, it's, you know, the ones that are very by the numbers found footage. And it's just, I can't. 15 minutes in, I'm like, I'm done. Sorry. Like, you see where it's going, kind of. So.
My least favorite horror genre is exemplified by one movie, which I hate and will never watch again. And it is Cannibal Holocaust. Like, schlocky, gore, exploitive, especially sort of like in the kind of like 50s, 60s, 70s era of, like, you know, where there were a little less restrictions on sort of like what people were putting on screen, or at least like, or more of a push to put like the grossest, worst, most like terribly, like, just gross schlock I do not like. And I don't like the sort of the non-filter of something that's like not even artsy or fun to watch or has a point, but is really just blood and guts and gore, in a really exploitive sense, because of course I love blood and guts and gore, but when you're just like sacrificing animals for film, like, I am not into that.
That's one movie that I have not watched specifically because I've heard that. And I read once that they actually were investigated because people thought that it was real. And I'm like, no, that's not for me. I think I'm going to stay away from that one. So,
yeah, I saw it as a midnight movie. Like a million years ago. And it seemed like, you know, from the description as a young horror fan, I was like, this is exactly, it seemed like something I would really enjoy. And I watched it just the whole time, hating every second of it. You know, it's also like incredibly racist. It's just, there's this scene that kind of like burns in my brain, of like when they're killing this large turtle, this like one of those really giant island turtles. And that scene, I remember watching that scene and being like, this can't be fake. You know, when you can just be like, this can't be fake. And I was so mad. I was so mad. And I was like a teenager that watched like Faces of Death. I was so, so, so mad at Cannibal Holocaust. And I just refuse to ever watch it again. Anything that even kind of touched on that, like from that era, like, I hate it. I hate it so much.
Tia, I have to ask, did you end up watching The Green Inferno? Eli Roth's take on it. Not a lot different, really. My opinion. I mean, I've seen Cannibal Holocaust, and I was just kind of like, okay. Like, it's like what you said. It could have been a lot better. I know a lot of people love it because of that gore you're speaking of. And I'm just kind of like, maybe, maybe this speaks about me being kind of desensitized. I was just watching it, just like, eh. Like I could do, I might own it. If I do, I've never watched it again after watching it.
That's how I kind of felt about Green Inferno. I haven't seen Cannibal Holocaust, but Green Inferno, there was such a to-do made about it. And I watched it and I was like, okay,
yeah.
Whatever.
It does make me want to watch Green Inferno though. Like I am like, I am interested. Maybe I'm just like a glutton for punishment, but just I'm like, actually, I should check that out. At least once, right?
Well, that leads me into what is your favorite horror film?
This is difficult.
It's very difficult.
But I think that like off the bat as something, as a casual answer, I probably always say The Descent.
Oh, it such a great movie.
Embodies so many things that I like. Interesting cast, sort of diversity in characters, you know, sort of exploring different friendships and the tensions between that, different relationships, plus lots of blood, really great looking monster, a kind of slow burn because it takes like a long time before the crawlers to show up. So a little psychological, beautiful cinematography. It definitely hits a lot of the things that I like about horror movies.
Yeah. Also impossible question. Thanks a lot,
Jerry. It's funny because I've only answered this question once and it's like the very first episode. And then after that, I changed my answer like every time. And I'm like, I'm just not going to answer it. I don't have to answer it.
Yeah, convenient.
Sure, you cannot answer it.
But sort of like what Chia said, like the one that comes to mind, the one I've probably watched the most, and it's probably a lot of people's, is The Shining. Mm. It's just a classic. I just love it. I remember reading it as a teenager, mm-hmm. and then watching it. And yeah, the performances, the filmmaking, I mean, you know, Jack Nicholson, you can't, Shelley Duvall, you just can't beat it.
I have to admit, I cheated a little bit on this question when you gave it to me, because it is damn near impossible to answer it. I guess the first one that really stuck with me is, and this is going to sound cliche, is Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Just because what you're seeing, you know, oh, it's not real, but in theory, mildly plausible, I guess. Mm-hmm. And as a younger mind, when I watched it, I'm just kind of like, this is awesome. Like it didn't require, we're talking pre-CGI. We're talking very, you know, base performances. I mean, good acting, if you will use that word, but, you know, but then more modern day, I was thinking, okay, what movie that I can think of more recently, and I'm talking like past 10, you know, 15 years even, really had an effect. And it was Martyrs, the first one, not the really bad remake. It's not a movie that I watch often. I've watched it maybe only like a handful of times, maybe four or five times in my life. And the first time I'd watched it, I was specifically told, like, I'm not going to tell you what this is about. You would just have to watch it. And so as not to spoil it for those people who might be listening who have never seen it, what I dug most about it is how, as it's the first half of the movie is taking place, it always felt to me like, oh, this is what they're doing. And then it's like, okay, it's not that. Oh, this is what they're doing. Oh, it's not that. And once you get halfway through and you realize just exactly what is now going to take place, it's like, wow, they really did a hell of a job kind of like weaving me through what I thought they were trying to rip off, only to find that that wasn't it even remotely. And when the thing was done, my wife and I just looked at each other like, what the hell did we just watch? And the effect at that point, I was just like, yeah, that was a solid flick. I mean, and there's other movies that I really dig that have come out more recently than that, but that there's my, unfortunately not that short of an answer.
No, that's okay. What was your first horror movie that you remember seeing?
I have to ask, Sherry, what was your favorite horror movie? Oh, you can't just leave us here like this.
Okay, so I'm going to go with, so today, because of the mood that I'm in today, because that's what right. I find, it depends on the mood that I'm in.
Totally.
Absolutely.
The first episode I said Drag Me to Hell, because I was like, I want something kind of fun, something that kind of does a good mix of scary and gross, but not too gory. But right now, I would say that it's The Exorcist.
That's a one of mine too.
It's just so good. I honestly think it's almost a perfect movie. I have a small group of horror friends that I met through the podcast, and we've talked about this, and two of them have never seen it. And I like try to convince them, you need to see The Exorcist, because if only to see like how well it is done, and how it's kind of like a documentary feel to it. I don't know. It's just, the acting is superb. There's just something about it that I also really enjoy demonic movies, Robin. So my favorites are also like generally like ghost stories or something to do with possessions. I think because it's something that I, as a skeptic, don't believe in. So it's always intriguing to me to watch. Whereas like slashers, like, and don't get me wrong, I love slashers, but I know that serial killers and mass murderers exist. So I have a different experience watching those than I do watching like ghost movies or possession movies. So, but ask me again at the end of the episode and I might say something completely different.
That's very fair.
Yeah. So first horror movie you remember seeing?
I'm going to go ahead and say that it was The Exorcist. Mm. This is something that I've talked about before. And if you know me, that this is a horror movie that is kind of hard for me to watch, because I watched it when I was so young. I also grew up in a very Catholic family. So like I saw it at an age where I, you know, was still very much sort of entrenched in the church and religion, but my family, we just like watching fun movies, I guess. So like, and I was like, just no restrictions or supervision. You know, I was like a young, like, this is like, I come from an immigrant family. There are no rules, like when it comes to content. So like, I saw it probably, you know, I don't know, when I was 10 or under.
Oh my.
And I was so scared. I was like, in the way that you talk about how like, you know, slasher films or sort of movies with serial killers hit a little different because that exists in the world. Like in my like 10-year-old brain, like the devil and being possessed existed to me in a very, very real way. So the first time I saw it, I was like, oh my God. Like, and I remember praying, like my little, like praying so hard, thinking that like, that could be me at any point. And like just my brain went through every sinful thing I'd ever done, anything, any sort of thing I'd ever touched. I was like, is that how I get possessed? No. I was so, and then I tricked myself into think, like I got a couple years older, like I was 12, and I tricked myself into thinking that I could watch it again. And I watched it again and had a terrible time again, also because Reagan in the movie is 12 years old. And so 12-year-old me really had a whole time with that. And then, you know, watched it again as an adult. And I think even as an adult, you know, even sort of like kind of, you know, undoing a lot of this Catholic upbringing, there's still something a little bit about it. I think it's just because it draws me back to being mm-hmm. that age and that's like that scared of that idea. But I know that it's a good movie. Like I know that it's a classic horror movie. I know that the acting is great. You know, I mean, it is special. The practical effects are excellent. Mm-hmm. It is genuinely creepy. These are all things that I know, but I do have a hard time watching it.
I bet. Like I didn't see that. So I did not watch horror movies when I was young until I was in my like early teens, probably around 12, 13 is when I started watching horror movies. And I refused to watch The Exorcist until I was in my 20s because I was like, nope, can't do it. That this one's just gonna, like, there's something about it that I just can't do. So I can't even imagine watching it when you were about the age of like the main character, the possessed character, like that's who you're gonna connect with, right? So
yeah, let me tell you, I did.
I don't remember if this was the actual first horror movie that I watched, but I was really into reading scary books when I was little, and I went through like kind of the classic Stephen King, and then my parents really loved Silence of the Lambs and handed me the book to read, and then it was like an event in my life. I think I was 12, maybe 13, where they said, okay, like you're gonna go sleep over at your aunt's house and you guys are going to watch Silence of the Lambs together. Like, cause this is a hard movie and we're going to see, you know, we're going to make sure that like, you're okay with this. And I loved it. I was so excited. And yeah, went over to my aunt's house. We made popcorn. We watched Silence of the Lambs when I was like 12 or 13. And I was like, this is it. This is what I love forever.
For me, I don't remember where I'm led to believe it was at my father's house. My parents were divorced. So at dad's house, when you were staying with him, he had cable and didn't really care what you were doing. Where I saw what I believe I had to look it up years ago, was the last third of Trilogy of Terror with Karen Black, where she played three different roles. Like, right. I've never seen the movie in its entirety, so putting that out there. But apparently she, in the movie, she plays in these three different small stories, three different people. And in the end, the last third, she is gifted, I guess the package shows up, a little Hopi doll with a little knife. And it comes to life.
Right.
And it chases her around the apartment. And that's what I saw as a kid. So if you want something that's going to completely warp your brain at a really young age, think of some little tiny thing you can't really catch with a knife chasing you around the house, aiming for your ankles and one of the belts. And all I can recall is her being chased, her screaming. And then I think she kills the doll by the doll. She like stands in front of the open oven and dodges just as it jumps at her and locks it in the oven and kills it by setting it on fire.
That way. So it's kind of the precursor to Chucky.
Yeah, yeah, in a way, in a way. I mean, between that and watching Mommy Dearest, that's that to me was a horror movie. So, yeah, totally. So, yeah, the wire hanger scene, well, is permanently burned into my brain. So yeah, that would be the first one though, is Trilogy of Terror.
Who's your ultimate final girl?
For me, it's Laurie Strode. I'm a Halloween girl. Same. Through and through. She's just, because especially now with the new movies, because like we've seen how this has affected her life, and like, sure, like the, I thought the new one was, you know, whatever. It was okay. It was fun. It wasn't super scary, but like she has turned into such like a badass, albeit a mentally unstable. Yeah. But like she's evolved, and she's never gonna die now instead of Michael Myers, right. And I love that. I just love her.
I was going to say Nancy Thompson because I'm a Nightmare on Elm Street person, but I really thought about it and I was like, actually I think my favorite final girl is Jess Bradford from Black Christmas.
Oh, good choice.
She's
a good one.
Yeah, right. She's like, because I like that she's smart, she's a little foul mouth, you know. but she's also she's brave, she's like, you know, appropriately scared. And the fact that there is just one Black Christmas movie, you know, there's aside from the remakes, but like there's I think something about that just also really gets to me. It's like, this is her story, we had it, and like we don't need to, you know, the continuation of it we don't necessarily need.
This was another hard question that you threw. And I really had to think about it. I absolutely love the Evil Dead reboot, and I love the character of Mia. I thought and there are so many good answers to the question, but I thought about her and her character and how here's someone trying to kick drugs. She gets possessed. The amount of hell that she goes through in the evening or that night in the cabin, and then finally she's like, all right, enough of this. And she comes back, and she rips her own arm off and then still kills, you know, the possessed version of her. And I'm just like, I pray for a sequel. And there's been talk of it for ages, and I don't think it's going to happen. And then it's odd to see her in, what is it, Zoe's Imaginary Playlist? What's the name of the show?
Yeah.
I'm like, what is this? Like, no. Make another Evil Dead movie. But yeah, I love her for that. I think she's such a great character. And yeah, here's to hoping. So
that is a good choice as well. All right. Now, lastly, how long would you last in a horror movie?
I would die before the movie even started. Like I would be the person who's like killed in the cold open that they don't find for the rest of the movie because I was too dumb and I was already dead.
I think that I would like to think that I would make it to the second act because I think that I would unfortunately be cast as like the quirky sidekick best friend, you know what I mean? That sort of like is really fun, real quippy, and sort of like helps the main character with the disbelief of like what's going on, you know, helps kind of push that a little bit, like, oh, you're crazy. I mean, like, someone is chasing you in the dark? No way. But I would, that would be turned on me, because then like right somewhere towards like the end of the second act, I would die.
I'd like to think three quarters of the way through. I guess it depends on the horror movie. I don't see myself ever making it to the end. But
I'm curious, Sherry, does anyone ever think that they'll make it to the end? I feel like a...
I've had a couple of people that said that they, you know, they do martial arts or whatever, so they think they'll make it to the end. And then some people will qualify and say, it depends on what kind of movie it is. If it is a slasher movie, I'm going to die right away. If it's another kind of horror movie, then I will make it to the end. So
literally every movie that I'm running through, I'm like, nope, I would die. Nope. Like, same. Zombies, same. I would make some sort of sound that I'd be trip over something and that would be that. like slasher, yeah. I'd be in the wrong place at the exact wrong time. Mm-hmm.
Same.
There's no way.
I always joke that I trip over my own feet, so I would 100% die pretty quickly.
Like, oh, me too.
All right. And I threw in a little bonus question just because of what we're going to talk about. So are you a fan of practical jokes and April Fool's Day in general?
No.
I didn't even have to think about it.
Hate pranks. I hate them. I hate them. There was one instance in my life where I was like super pranked and it turned out bad for everybody.
Oh no. You know,
it was just like, it was just not no one enjoyed it. No one had a good time. Not even the person who pulled the prank eventually, you know? So I just, I would not like to be, let's say, a member of this group of friends at all.
Fair enough.
I don't mind pranks. Well, I don't necessarily like big pranks. I think I kind of like, I don't have the right reaction to like pranks. I don't think people like, you know, people, I think when people prank other people, they want a big reaction, like really scared or something. And I tend to be pretty, I don't know what's wrong with me. I tend to be very neutral where I'm like, I get it. You got me. And I don't know why I'm like that, but I am a big fan of what I like to call is the safe prank. Which actually, incidentally, is how me and Robin's husband became friends. Many, many years ago, we met each other and through mutual friends, and we had decided within 10 minutes of meeting each other to engage in a safe prank war. And it was basically, and it was like putting like baby carrots into his pocket or like, you know, and it was like not safe pranks. Do you know what I mean? Like nothing serious. And that's how I became friends with Shane, Robin's husband.
Love it.
You know, I'm not anti-prank. Is the question more, would I create the pranks? I mean, I'm cool with having pranks done to me, although it doesn't happen really ever. It feels like a lot of work. I got a lot going on right now. you know, it'd be, I'd love to do stuff like I mean, we shrink wrapped a car a long time ago, like stuff like that. Nothing really.
The whole car?
Kind of like, yeah. Oh, this is way back in my teenage days. Like if you have like,
Brian, don't gloss over that. You have to start from the beginning.
It was basically a bunch of us worked together at a grocery store. This was like late high school, early college. We're talking like early 90s to put it, to kind of date myself. And we've got access to the big rolls of shrink wrap that are about, you know, I'm holding my hands up like you're going to hear it. Like 3 feet long or whatever. And yeah, if you've got a hatchback, which my friend did, he had like a Ford Escort type deal or something. We just ran out there and just, you run around the car and shrink wrap it.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And in hindsight, it doesn't sound really all that great, but it's like, that's the sort of stuff that we would do. But like now it's like, hey, Ryan, you want to go shrink wrap a car? No. I got stuff going on. You know, it's like that sort of thing. It's like, you know, I don't know.
Right.
Priorities.
All right. So let's get into the movie. So the IMDb summary, 9 college students staying at a friend's remote island mansion begin to fall victim to an unseen murderer over the April Fool's Day weekend, but nothing is as it seems. Fairly accurate. So it was part of a like 1980s like fad, I guess, of using like slasher movies that had to do with either holidays or like dates. Like obviously Friday the 13th is one that comes to mind, but there was prom night, My Bloody Valentine, Slumber Party Massacre, and all kinds of different things like that. But there was also 3 horror movies in 1986 that take place on April Fool's Day. So there's Killer Party and Slaughter High, neither of which I have seen.
Those sound great.
They do, right? It would be a good trip.
They sound great.
Yeah, yeah.
written by Danilo Bach, who also wrote Beverly Hills Cop, and directed by Fred Walton, who had previously directed When a Stranger Calls, which is a great movie. Oddly enough, did not realize that it was directed by the same person, and I watched When a Stranger Calls yesterday, like just coincidentally.
Spooky.
Right? Produced by Frank Mancuso Jr., who had produced in various capacities five Friday the 13th films. So he produced 2, 3, 4, 5, and 7. He would also later produce the direct-to-video remake of April Fool's Day. Has anybody seen that?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, I watched it. I have not.
I also watched it earlier today. You have not watched it, Sherry?
No, I haven't watched it.
I'm going to say you should.
Certainly something.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to get your take on it a little bit later, but I will watch it maybe later today. My favorite thing was that Amy Steele, who plays Ginny in Friday the 13th Part 2, she's the final girl. She plays Kit Graham in the movie, who is probably my favorite character in April Fool's Day.
Why is she your favorite character?
I just like that she kind of stays calm and cool throughout the movie. She kind of figures out what's going on. Well, not everything that's going on, but she figures out the kind of the Buffy St. John story and kind of puts the pieces together, and she fights right till the end. So that's why I think she's my favorite.
I think she wore the best outfits too.
She did. Like she had the like the shirt with the tie on at one point. Uh-huh. Like, yeah.
I would hesitate to say that was the best outfit. It was an outfit.
It was an outfit. Well, what was the best outfit then?
Well, you know, I did like the play of Buffy St. John, like when she first appears and she's really like made up, very posh looking, and then like when she turns into her, mm-hmm. you know, her twin, where she dresses down, and suddenly her hair, and it was such a cinema way of dressing down a beautiful woman, just to be like, oh, her hair's a little messy. Yeah. She's
wearing, the makeup's different a little bit. She looks like she has bags under her eyes. Yeah.
So I was very, very into that as the like, oh, is it the same person? I thought that was probably my favorite outfit.
I mean, at least she didn't take off her glasses and then all of a sudden she was beautiful. I mean, that's right.
I think they were very close to doing that, though. They were right on the edge of doing that.
Probably. Actually, I think the best outfit is Skip's. I think it's Skip. No, it's Chaz. Chaz's outfit when they're playing soccer, and he's got those weird patterned pants on, and he's got a big baggy vest over his t-shirt. Mm-hmm. Oh, 1986.
Really excellent. Really excellent.
It was filmed mostly in British Columbia, but it's supposed to be set apparently in Maine. It was originally released on March 27th, 1986, on 1,202 screens across the U.S., The budget was $5 million. Any guess what the domestic box office was?
I think it did really well, right? I would maybe triple that. I don't know. 20 million?
That was kind of going to be my guess. Yeah.
Yeah, right?
13. So 13. Close. Yeah, you said said triple. So that's almost. Yeah. Yeah. It earned $3.4 million alone during its opening weekend. So it's a pretty successful opening weekend. It was a commercial success, but apparently they thought that the director, Fred Walton, thought that Paramount didn't really know how to release it or how to market it other than as a typical slasher film. So a lot of people went in and didn't see quite what they had expected to see. So critical reaction was split. So there were people that enjoyed it. The Washington Post wrote that the suspense sequences are stylishly managed and Walton has attractively cast the movie with a number of natural, if unexciting, actors. Then there were some people that said, nothing in the film is quite what it seems to be, not always intentionally. The characters are as interchangeable as the actors who play them. Which I would agree. I actually, when I watched it again, I had to take notes about, okay, so which one is this? And like I had defining characteristics that like made me remember, okay, so that's Chaz, right? So,
right.
Yeah. I would definitely agree that they were a little interchangeable, even though I think they were kind of supposed to be like the super posh kid and the kid that couldn't get into medical school. You know, yep. I think they were kind of playing on this like brat pack kind of like trope of each kind of young person from school. but it didn't quite translate that way because they were all just sort of generically good looking young people.
Yeah. Rich, preppy.
Yeah.
And I think a handful of them were supposed to be like not so rich because they make a comment about Rob not being in private school like the rest of them. He's just in a community college kind of thing. But you can also tell by their names because there's there's Muffy, Buffy, Arch, Skip, Chaz, and Kit.
Those were very excellent. Real like Sweet Valley High.
Yes.
Kind of names. And also characters, right? And even like the little bit of the sort of like teen drama kind of vibes from it was like I definitely was like, oh, this is like a cool slasher Sweet Valley High.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So the movie starts with some friends. They're all standing on a pier. One of them is filming everyone. It's spring break and they're headed to their friend Muffy's house on a secluded island. I found it was a good way to introduce everyone kind of quickly. You learned most of the characters' names, although you might forget them shortly after because, as we said, they're kind of interchangeable. And then we flash to Muffy in her cellar and she's cleaning up her naked mannequins. Maybe that's part of having a secluded island house is that you have naked mannequins in the cellar.
Sorry, do you not on your on your weekend home?
Not the one on the island. The one up in the mountains, that one we do. She tells the housekeeper that the weekend is going to be bloody unforgettable. And then there's this weird little flashback where she finds a dusty Jack in the Box on the shelf. And we see this flashback where she's given this as a birthday gift. Jack in the Boxes are weird toys for kids.
Terrifying. Yeah. Like terrifying, like as is. And they changed it. So a little monster thing popped out.
Yeah.
And she's like a child. I wanted to know if this was like her introduction to her family's weird obsession with pranks or if this was something she was already used to.
Oh, smart. Yeah, maybe.
I was like, if this was her first one, like if I was that child, I would be traumatized for life and never want to pull a prank or be part of a prank again. But maybe this was already something that she loved.
Jack in the Box is her origin story for becoming the ultimate prankster.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good, I didn't even think about that, but that's probably what it is. Back at the ferry, we have more people joining the crowd. They don't really all know each other, but they all know Muffy. We meet Chaz, who, as I said, films everything. We have Nan, who is the intellectual. She's reading Paradise Lost on the ferry. She also gives a little hint to kind of the resolution of the movie when she says that she and Muffy met in drama class. We have Nikki. She's the vivacious one, we'll say. We have Kit, who my observation was just long blonde hair, but then ended up becoming one of my favorite characters. Rob is the medical school one, as you mentioned. Hal, aka Harvey, is very awkward. He is a farmer's kid and kind of wants to move up in the world. So he has this big plan for, I think, like proposing to Muffy or something. So they actually assembled the crew, the cast, at a hotel in Vancouver just prior to filming so that they could hang out and build a rapport and start to make it believable that they were actually friends. There's a lot of joking back and forth, very juvenile jokes. Like these are like college kids, but they're, well, I guess college kids make juvenile jokes. There's lots of jokes about flies being open and your hostess Twinkie hanging out, that sort of thing.
Yes, I feel like they really immediately were peppering in all of the pranks. Like it was like kind of a never ending, like,
right.
Don't forget, it's April Fool's. Like it is, here's a prank, here's another joke, here's another, you know what I mean? To really, I think, and it was like, I mean, obviously knowing the ending now, watching it again, like watching these early scenes is like, oh yeah, they were winking at us very hard as an audience. They were really just jabbing us in the ribs every single joke. Like, don't forget, it's all a joke. It's all a joke.
Yeah. There was one of the things I had thought about in watching it again. There's a ton of foreshadowing.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and,
yeah.
And the whole time, I think one of the reviews you said where one of the critics said that nothing is really as it seems, that really is the case. Like throughout the entire thing, not only do you have this foreshadowing of pranks, these things happen, and then it's still like you have that resolution at the end of all the pranks that are taking place. But mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't take anything you're seeing on screen, including Nan, Nan, right, who's supposed to be that outsider, right up to the very end, it turns out, you know, she's in some way in on it too, which I think is kind of awesome about it.
And then you have other characters that you think have no relation to each other, but then end up being related.
Yep.
And yeah, so it right away, you're right. It just throws it right in there at you. And then, so we have Arch and Skip, they're playing some weird knife throwing game with each other, but this also turns out to be an April Fool's joke, because Arch seems to get frustrated. He throws the knife at Skip. Skip takes it in the stomach and stumbles back off the ferry into the water.
Which is the worst prank.
It's terrible.
Right? It is like the idea of the prank being that you accidentally stabbed your friend and he falls off of the boat. I think at that point I would be like, okay, guys, I got to go home. I cannot. This is the beginning of the weekend, we're not even on the island. This is not for me.
Yeah. And you're already pretending to kill each other. And also, like, so Rob jumps into the water. Buck, who is the, works on the boat, he also jumps into the water to rescue Skip. And then they're like, ah, ha, 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 April Fools. 100%, I would be with you. I'd be like, nope, that's it. The weekend's over. Turn this boat around.
Are we actually friends? Who are these people? This is a very interesting friendship dynamic, that this is like humor, you know?
Yeah. Right.
Buck decides to stay in the water to tie up the boat to the dock, which turns out to be a bad idea when he gets squished, or so we think, between the boat and the dock. And he takes a lot of bloody damage to his face. And it looks like his eye is kind of hanging.
Yeah. Somehow he smashed up against the dock and then it pulled his eye out.
But just a small little section too. Like everything else is fine.
The first time I watched it, which was for this, did you guys think like, oh, why didn't he just move out of the way of the boat?
100%.
He had to swim backwards. There was space. Yeah. He's in the water. You know, there's space under the dock where the boat can't get him. I think that was like I think an early moment of like, wait, what's going on here? And I was like, I couldn't tell if it was like, you know, like poor writing or if there was something going on, because an immediate thought is like, oh, this is maybe just not that good of a movie. Like they're just, you know, there's this already a little plot hole here.
Yeah.
See, and going off that, that's kind of what I had thought, because even going into this movie, the first time I watched it, whenever I see that sort of thing happen, where you're like, why did that take place? Isn't that sort of thing avoidable? I'm like, oh, it's an 80s horror movie, so it's got to be bad writing.
Right. Yeah, that's true exactly enough. What I thought. Yeah,
that's the way I would look. I've looked at a lot. It's usually that's well, Amazon.
A really sneaky way for them to get around.
Right?
Yeah. They're relying on the bad writing reputation. Yeah. And luckily, a police officer just happens to be cruising around in his little motorboat. So Buck and the ferryman, instead of him, the police officer taking them, which seems weird to me, Buck and the ferryman take his boat to get to the hospital. So Muffy then appears. So this is the first time we meet Muffy St. John, which sounds like the most yuppie name ever written.
Yeah,
I loved how at one point too they were like, "That's her real name." Like, thought it was. Right. It had to be a nickname, but it's not. It's her real name.
She asks what's going on. The police officer or constable asks if her dad is around, and she's like, "No, he's back home, but nobody's heard from him." And the constable looks a little like, "Interesting." The person that plays a Muffy is Deborah Foreman, and she actually auditioned early for the role, but they didn't feel like that she was right for the part. So they actually were close to signing several other actresses, but then they backed out for various reasons. So she really wanted the part. She auditioned again, and it was the second audition that landed her the role.
I loved her as Muffy.
Yeah, she was great.
That's a good lesson from the movie.
So now the constable needs to take her boat, because his is being used to transport Buck to the mainland. How convenient that they're going to be stuck on this island with no way off of it.
I really like that. It, and then again, sort of on rewatch of it, it was like understanding all the sort of like kind of slasher movie tropes that they really hit on. And you know, one of the things and that's in a lot of horror movies is the sort of the glimmer of hope at the end, like the limited time, like they are on this island without another ferry, but for a limited time.
Yep.
So if they could just survive until then. And I think like that is something that I thought about that was so smart, because it shows up, you know, like in every horror movie, there's always like the glimmer of an escape, right? You know, in a vampire movie, it's like the sun's going to come up eventually, or on this, where it's like a weekend getaway, they have a possibility of escape if they can just last the 2 days.
Yeah.
And I like that tension that they put on, that they put on this movie immediately, is like, oh, they're going to an island and there's no other ferry.
That's a good point. And yeah. I think when you take away that hope, it just becomes so bleak.
Yes. Yes.
So they head to Muffy's house, and it's pretty massive. I'm not going to lie. It's quite a nice place. The view is stunning that they've got, and they have the dining room table. It's all set. There are Barbie-like dolls sitting on all the plates. So it's kind of like their place markers, which is a little off, but.
That's probably the moment where I would have been like, nope, no, thank you. I'm out.
You're just going to go wait on the dock.
Yeah. I'll swim back to shore.
Muffy will inherit the house in a month when she turns 21, we learn, if all goes well. So everyone seems to have recovered pretty quickly from the trauma of Buck's accident.
Yes. <Yep. laughs> I laughed so hard when they were like in the car, had like these bleak faces on, and then they were just sort of like, I guess we have to go have fun now.
yeah, right? They're like, yeah, let's do this cosmopolitan quiz. And yeah. You know.
No one thought to question this whole, I think his eye came out of his face.
Yeah, they were sad thing. About it for like right, 5 minutes. Right, they were
sad.
They weren't going to let it ruin their weekend. So.
Priorities. They do have that little scene in the kitchen where they're doing this, it's like a cosmopolitan style quiz, and the women are like cooking. Apparently this actually happened because the person that played Kit was reading a cosmopolitan questionnaire to her co-stars, and then they all started talking about it. The director saw it and was like, I love this, let's put this in the movie. Oh. So they actually improvised that scene.
I like that scene. I liked also, again, another like slasher trope setup of like young women like that are being very sexual and like sort of like talking about sex in this very mm-hmm. you know, in a very like straightforward way.
Yep.
And I definitely like had the little like ding in my brain where I was like, oh, slasher movie. Like that particular characterization was so prevalent, especially in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And I liked that little extra scene a lot.
Everyone is now exploring the house. Arch, when he's like, lifestyles of the rich and undeserving, I thought was really funny. That was probably one of the funniest moments of the movie. And there's a little bit of an attempt to develop the characters, but not too much, because Skip and Nan have a conversation about Skip's relationship with his dad, because he's blaming himself for Buck's injury. He's the only one that seems to actually have any kind of lasting effects from seeing this happen.
Yeah.
But then later on, you learn that this may not be actually the case. And it seems kind of like it kind of ruins that scene a little bit when you realize what actually happens at the end of the movie. So they then sit down to this beautiful dinner of beans and wieners, complete with candlelight. And the practical jokes keep coming. So we've got, these ones are a little more innocent though. We've got a whoopee cushion. Mm-hmm. There's the chair legs that bend so that when somebody leans back, they fall over.
Also a terrifying prank, even as a safe prank, that seems like
it's a little too dangerous.
It's like someone could get really hurt.
Skip is the only one not at dinner, so he's outside drinking straight from the bottle, seemingly still rocked by the incident on the boat earlier. Muffy makes a toast about friendship, and Nan makes comments about friendship, and everybody's all lovey-dovey inside, and the jokes continue as the champagne glasses leak all over them.
It is relentless.
Like, I literally, as I'm taking notes watching the movie, I was like, oh, there's another practical joke. There's another practical joke. Well, there's another one.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm curious, and maybe I didn't look this up, but I'm curious, maybe one of you knows. Was this like a thing for that time frame? Like for in the 80s, was it like a big deal? You know, was it up there with like Velcro sneakers and, you know, I'm just trying and growing up in the 80s, like I never thought like doing pranks and April Fool's Day stuff was a real, like a fad.
Not to this extent. Yeah.
No, I mean, and maybe I have to watch those other two movies you spoke of and see if that was like, I mean, Yeah, I don't know. I'm just curious.
Do you think it was, there a sort of an April Fool's Day kind of holdover from, say, like in the 70s when a lot of like probably maybe 50s, 60s, 70s, and where it's like a lot of fraternities and sororities on campuses would do big April Fool's Day pranks, mm-hmm. or like the senior prank, you know? Because mm-hmm. even though like I never went to a school that had any of that, it was something that I was aware of as something that happened
like culturally.
That happened culturally, but I think specifically with sort of universities and sort of like higher ed, or definitely, you know, like the trope of the like the senior prank, mm-hmm. which I think that probably by the 80s maybe like fell out of fashion because people were getting hurt.
But, yeah,
you know, maybe like it, right?
We probably all just like chose the right friends. Like I'm sure that there were groups of douchebags doing this all over the place, you know? Yeah. Yeah. I just didn't know them.
Yeah.
But I mean, I remember like, you know, fun prank stuff that was available as a kid, you know, like
cushions
or like electric buzzers, and that seemed to be like, you know, there was always like ads in the back of comic books for like send away for your prank kit. And I feel like, you know, I feel like when I was younger, there were like magic stores that sold like you know, magic kits and pranks and things, and that mm-hmm. seemed more prevalent when I was younger. But I don't. But again, I also, yeah, like Robin said, I had better friends, or I had friends that did not find that stuff interesting.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question, though, Ryan. Like I'm trying to think back, and like you said too, yet like I feel like there were lots of shops around like that, right, where you could go and get like that stuff. But I don't remember it being a bigger thing.
Yeah.
But it was the 80s, so you know, maybe it was, the 80s were a weird time.
Oh, they were. I mean, I know that some of the more, how do I put this, the intellectual schools. Like I know, like I still hear or read the occasional story of like at MIT they do something weird, or at Stanford they do some crazy prank, or you know, schools prank each other during like the annual rival football.
Oh, right, when they steal the mascot or something.
Yeah, things of that nature. So I'm sure it's got to be rooted in something, but.
And I mean, they do go to Vassar.
Right.
Yeah.
It's one of it's Ivy League. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just find it fascinating that they'd be so into it. Like, obviously, this is the precursor of video games, because if you gave the kids an Atari, they'd just be sitting around playing games. That's back true. In the 80s.
That Coleco is true. Version.
I don't know.
Oh, hiding in television in the 80s. It was fantastic. There's kind of this weird dynamic between Muffy and Nikki. So after dinner, as she's getting settled into her room, Nikki basically tells Muffy that Chaz is hers back off. But I don't feel like you get any kind of like, there's no inkling that Muffy is going to put the moves on Chaz, or that Muffy is really there to steal Nikki's boyfriend at all. So I'm not really sure what the point of that is, other than to maybe kind of establish that Nikki and Muffy have this kind of adversarial relationship already. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do think that was sort of set up to create that tension and that rivalry, mm-hmm. you know, because I think that a lot of the movie is predicated on the mystery of who the killer is. Even before anyone gets killed, you know that it's got to be one of them, or you get the sense that it's going to be one of them. And so I think setting up that like rivalry, and I think that's, and honestly, I think that's just, you know, not necessarily bad writing, but just like easy writing to sort of like set up rivalry between two women by putting like a man between them, you know? And I think that was just sort of like an easy out to be like, okay, we need these two women to be a little bit like bickering at each other.
Right. Everyone heads to their rooms. Hal is practicing his super romantic pitch to Muffy before he finds odd newspaper clippings about deadly car crashes in the room. So this is the first of kind of the more serious, I don't want to say pranks because this isn't really a prank, but the more serious things that people start to find in their room. Practical jokes, however, still keep coming. There's the faucet that sprays Nikki in the face. There's the exploding cigar that Hal is smoking. Then Arch finds heroin paraphernalia in his medicine cabinet, while Nikki finds some bondage gear. We later learn that Hal was involved in a car accident that I'm guessing killed some people. Do we think then that Arch like is a drug addict and Nikki is into S&M?
Those were wild revelations. those were very odd. The heroin specifically for me was like, what is the joke here?
Right. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, but it was a little, it was sinister, and it did correctly put a lot of question marks into the air,
mm-hmm.
of like, what's going on? Because there's definitely something deeper going on. And sort of the idea of giving all the different characters sort of like deep, dark secrets, I think to further the plot of like creating tension among all of them, this sort of like, especially like from the earlier scene when they're all talking about friendship and just being mm-hmm. together all the time. But in the way that in a similar way that Clue is set up, where it's like, oh, you actually find out these people don't know each other or don't like each other, or that it's like, it's a friendship built on lies. And I think like that is where the writers are really trying to sort of continue to build up tension. It is a very weird way to do it with a bag of heroin. I don't understand.
I also felt like maybe that's what they were trying to do, but we don't see them question each other about the things that they found, you know, yeah, like they totally. Just kind of like are like, oh no, and then ignore them. And
then... it's true.
So it's like, yeah. So it's sort of like you expect them to be much more traumatized than they actually end up being.
I mean, they don't seem traumatized by much though.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
That's true.
So Rob and Kit have a painting in their room and the eyes move. Another practical joke. It's just a cat clock behind the painting. And then we have probably the most disturbing of the little things that are found. We hear a baby crying and Nan seems very disturbed. She tries to find it. It's just a recording. And the tape recorder is hidden in a cupboard. Definitely a weird vibe. In some cases, it's definitely playful, harmless stuff, but in other cases, it's much darker. And as you said, sinister, like it becomes very sinister in some spots. Arch can't catch a break. So he finds the heroin stuff, the heroin paraphernalia in his medicine cabinet. He tries to get some action with Muffy, but she rebuffs him before going into her room. And then he walks in on Nikki and Chaz, who are just a mass of tangled up limbs.
Hilarious. Amazing. Yes.
I was like, what are they doing?
Right. I love that.
I'm glad
humor.
They cut back to it for a second time, because I was like, wait a second.
Yeah.
The pretzel.
How were they positioned?
Was so funny. I thought that was so funny. It was just like, I love a little humor in a slasher movie. Again, I think kind of pulls us back, like after these sort of other odd revelations with S&M, it's like, oh, by the way, we're still very goofy. Very, very goofy over here.
Mm-hmm.
I loved that. I thought it was so good.
He decides to take some solace with some pornography before he leans back in his chair and once again falls backwards. Poor Arch. Meanwhile, Skip has been outside getting more and more drunk, and he decides to go to the boathouse. So I'm a big nerd and I am currently working on a cross stitch pattern that is how to survive a horror movie. And the line that I'm actually stitching right now is turn on a light. And I'm like, turn on a light, Skip, just turn on a light in the boathouse.
Yeah.
He hears something. He cries out, who's there, before a cat pounces on him. Which is a little nod to Friday the 13th part 2, in which Alice, a cat jumps on Alice in that movie. There's another nod later on to it when Arch gets hung upside down in a rope, just like Scott in Friday the 13th part 2, which was also starred Amy Steele, AKA Kit, and was produced by Don Mancuso Jr. So little connection there. But he's okay. He's fine. It was just a cat. But nope, then he gets grabbed from behind and we see him pulled off screen. So the next morning, Muffy's making breakfast. And as we talked about earlier, she just seems off. She's jumpy. Her hair is a mess. She oddly doesn't seem like the same person.
Or so you would think.
Or so you would think.
I love her frizzy hair. Really great costuming.
Yeah. So most of the group goes to play soccer on the lawn while Nan does some studying. She notices Muffy going into like another small house on the property. Rob and Kit at this point sneak off to the boathouse to have some alone time. And as they're making out while lying on the floor, Kit sees the body of Skip float by through the slats of the floor under them. which I thought was a great reveal. I figured it was coming, but it's still a like, great reveal of Skip's dead body.
I loved how they showed it like three different times, three different angles.
In case you didn't see it before, we're gonna play it again. Oh wait, one more time. Yeah. Rob thinks it's a practical joke, which, you know, based on Skip's history, I feel like is fair, and based on the way the weekend is going, it's fair.
Yeah.
But Kit isn't convinced, so they go back to tell the rest of the gang. No one has seen him since last night, so they all go out looking for him. Arch immediately suspects Buck, the guy whose eye was hanging out the day before. So yes, he came back. He's fine now, and he's like taking his revenge. Nan confronts Muffy about the baby tape. She's very shook. She's like, how did you find out? Was it one of his preppy friends? Muffy denies knowing anything. She's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And then they kind of separate as Arch goes out in the woods looking for Skip. And there's a snake. He doesn't see the snake, though, nor does he see the rope trap that he just walks into and that gets him strung up in the air. So we see the legs of someone approach him as he's hanging there. We never actually see the killer. We just see the legs. I use the word killer loosely. See the legs of somebody approaching him. Now that Arch is missing, they decide to try calling the police, but they can't get through.
Of course.
Right. Another great little slasher trope. Yeah. Because you want to call for help, but you can't. Yeah. It's always, yeah, you have to give yourself a limited amount of time to escape, and but also take away all forms of communication to the outside world, to the police, etc.
Muffy is not worried about them. She thinks they're probably playing some stupid trick, she says. At this point, Nikki and Hal have to go to the well to get some water because the water main is broken. I feel like I've never seen a horror movie where wells were innocuous.
Right.
Any horror movie that I can think of that has a well in it, it is always a bad thing.
Yes. Yes, it is.
I think I literally wrote down, you don't go in a well. You just
don't. You don't go in a well.
No.
When she starts climbing down the rung, and yep. I had two like the idea that they're going to get water because the water main is broken. Something in my brain is like, how much water are they going to bring back? Right. What's going on? Like, are they just bringing back buckets of water to the house? It's a whole, that was one thing. And then, yeah, but when she started going down the rungs, the tension is like, as an audience, like we all know, yeah, you don't go into a well. Of course you're going to find a dead body down there. I mean, that's fully what I expect.
Down three.
Yes.
Yeah, she finds Skip and Arch's heads and Nan's body, which, you know, if you're ever going to go back into a well, I feel like that's going to stay in your mind and be like, maybe not. I don't want to find another dead body. It does lead to a great moment, though, later on when Muffy goes to give her some water. And she's like, no water from the well.
She's scared of the water. My favorite line, I think, in the entire movie is Muffy saying, it's all right. It's Perrier.
I also noted that because that was also probably one of my favorite lines.
Oh, like, so
just
good.
Something about it, just excellent timing on it too. Yeah.
So that well scene was actually shot in a tank on an LA soundstage at the end of production, and it was dyed to look murky. Oh. Crew members would actually throw their cigarette butts into the tank. And the actress that played Nikki spent so much time submerged in that water that she left with an ear infection.
Oh no. Ugh.
Isn't that wretched?
That's terrible.
Yeah.
The idea of sort of, you know, risking yourself, getting an infection for a scene that's like 2 minutes long. Mm-hmm.
In April Fool's Day, too. Yeah. Like, it's not like she was winning an Oscar for this movie.
Right.
While they're back inside, Kit's trying to comfort Nikki. She's like, it's okay. They were all outside and we're inside. I don't think she understands how doors and windows work, but, you know, whatever. They now receive a call from the constable who tells them that it can't be Buck because he's at the hospital right now. He's been there all day visiting him. So the constable's on his way. He'll send a flare up when he gets there. They can all meet him at the dock. But he says something that we don't hear to Rob because that's who he's talking to on the phone. And he basically, we learn later, he tells him not to trust anyone. They decide to check all the doors and windows to make sure they're secure, but they're already open. I mean, the killer could already be inside. Also, they don't check the basement window that is propped open and that they get into, two of them get into later. No one seems too concerned, again, that their friends have died. These people are, Like, they have nerves of steel. They do not, they're not fazed by Buck's injury. Yeah. They're not fazed by the fact that three of their friends have died.
Right. None of them are like, is there another way off of the island?
Yeah.
Like, right. There must be a rowboat or something. You can't, you know what I mean? Just for general safety. I mean, there's a whole boathouse.
That's true.
Yeah. No one seems that, like, they seem all very mildly panicked.
Well, it's almost like it's that fooling of oneself where the concept, I mean, we've seen this in other movies too, where it's like, oh, they're probably just blank. They're like, how big is the island? They're probably on the other side of it. Like, it's that sort of thing. Like, you know, they just went for an extremely long hike or something. I feel it goes back to, you know, a lot of those other 80s movies where they use that kind of self-delusion to make themselves feel better. I mean, I don't think we've seen, I think at this point, other than the bodies in the well, we haven't seen any other, we haven't been shown them. You see Arch, you know, you don't see him get killed.
Right.
And so since they have no visible proof, except for Nikki in the well, seeing the bodies, no one's come face to face with that true terror of their friends being murdered.
And that kind of makes sense because Nikki is the only one that I would say does seem kind of like, she seems the most panicked.
Yeah.
And she's the one that's come literally face to face with.
Yeah.
Right.
Decapitated heads. Yeah. Kit finds a picture of two little kids in the study before Muffy comes in all menacing. And she says, sometimes it takes someone all night to get here from the mainland. And sometimes they never make it. And she like tilts her head down. Like she's very, like, very menacing.
How long did it take them to get to the island?
Not long at all. Not long at all. Nikki comments about how different Muffy has been acting all day, and she talks about her nurse's shoes.
Yeah.
Which then leads them into a discussion about the things they found in their room. So Hal mentions that Nan and Muffy were arguing earlier about the stuff in Nan's room, about an abortion. Chaz gets up in Hal's face about what he found because Hal was in the car crash. So they talk about loyalty and friendship, totally out the window. Everyone is on high alert. They're like bickering back and forth. But instead of sticking together, they decide to stay within shouting distance of each other. But Rob says he's going to find a way into the attic because he'll be able to see the constable better from there. Nikki is fed up. She's ready to go. And she tells Chaz, three people are dead and you're telling me to relax, before he tells her to lighten up a bit. That's the worst thing to tell to somebody. Like, just relax. You're fine. It's fine.
Oh, yeah.
Your three friends are dead, but it's okay.
Yeah.
Chaz starts trying on all the bondage masks before Nikki walks out of the room. And she returns to the room, and Chaz is now lying on the bed. He's holding his hands over his groin, and she keeps talking to him, telling him, put it back in your pants. And then she swats his hands away, only to find a bloody hole in his pants. There's not much blood in this movie, but that's one of the bloodiest scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That was definitely pretty grotesque, but also very humorous, honestly. It is. Because you know that he's dead. Just as the viewer, you know he's dead. Yeah. You're waiting for the reveal of how he died. And I think, like, you know, first time watching that, I'm going through, it was like, oh, maybe he was suffocated.
Right.
In whatever thing. So to have him have some odd, like, penis death was very funny in the context of this movie.
Yes.
I like the little bit of shock, the extra gore. I did appreciate the very, very weird nature of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Although it didn't quite seem like an injury that you necessarily would die from.
Also, I did.
I mean, not that quickly. You might bleed out, but
after a while.
And also quietly, because I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
It's true. We do see someone again walk into the room, don't see the killer, but we move up to the attic with Rob and Kit, and Rob reveals that the constable told him not to trust anyone and that no one should be left alone with anyone, especially with Muffy. So Muffy's been playing with dolls again, and the dolls from the dinner table are upstairs, and she's recreated their deaths. So there's what's her name? Nan. There's a little Nan doll. And then there's a little Arch and Skip head in a little bowl filled with water. There's Nikki and Chaz all bloody laying on a bed. Like, it's messed up. and then there's the other four of them just kind of sitting off to the side still because they haven't died yet. Rob and Kit decide to head back downstairs to try and find their surviving friends, but they separate, which is always a bad idea. Like,
don't separate.
Don't.
They do reunite safely before finding a bloody crime scene in Nikki's room. So this is definitely the goriest scene in the movie, when you just see the blood dripping and there's like the pool of blood on the ground. They then find Hal's body hanging from a noose in Muffy's room, which I believe is where the inspiration for the VHS cover comes from, which is brilliant. And it's time to go to the pier because the flare has gone off. So Constable Potter should be here. When they get to the pier, he's not around. So they decide to take the boat, but there's no key.
Of course.
They remember conveniently there's a key in the kitchen. So they're about to go there, but they find a notice that Miss St. John has escaped from a mental institution where she has been for the past 3 years, and she is believed to be unstable and extremely dangerous heading home.
I loved this moment because Kit is like, she hasn't been institutionalized for the last 3 years. She's been at Vassar. She still doesn't feel like.
That's a good joke. That's a good little joke.
The picture that she saw with the two little kids in it at that moment. It still takes her a while.
It does take her a while. Yeah. And I mean, it's funny that they say Miss St. John instead of saying Buffy St. John. Like, it's just, it's Miss St. John is missing. So they enter the house through a propped open basement window, which we saw Muffy prop open earlier when she was cleaning before everyone arrived. And they see a trail of blood. They follow it to a stove, which they open, like a wood-burning stove, I think, to find Muffy's clothes. So this is when Kit has her big revelation. She's like, oh my God, Muffy has a twin sister, Buffy, because she sees growth charts written on the wall.
The reveal of the name Buffy made me cackle out loud. I loved it so much. Muffy and Buffy, of course.
Same. So excellent. Yeah, so good.
The painting that they had moved from the bedroom is in the basement now, and their eyes peering out from behind it. So Rob tells Kit to pull the painting away, and there's Muffy's decapitated head. Rest in peace, Muffy. Meanwhile, evil twin Buffy has closed the basement window. Rob and Kit have no choice but to run upstairs. Rob gets somehow locked in a closet. I wasn't quite sure how that happened, but
yeah, it wasn't clear.
We'll never know.
Definitely wasn't clear.
And Buffy and Kit face off. So they kind of do this little dance around the kitchen dining room. And the music is very ominous. Buffy raises the knife and approaches before Kit escapes through the double doors into the study. And here's the really big reveal of the movie, because everyone is just hanging out in the study, reading, talking, and they're completely oblivious to the fact that she just walked through. Like, they don't even acknowledge that she's come into the room. So what did you think when you saw the big reveal?
I had a, like, my first thought as it was like happening was like, oh wait, is this one of these weird dream movies? You know, like,
that's
like,
what I thought too.
Right? Is this a dream? Yeah. Is this is this a hallucination? You know, I was like, is this like the end of the descent? But then like, as it is revealed that the whole thing is an April Fool's, that we've been April Fool's, I was a little mad. Like, I was upset. I was like, are you kidding me? Everyone's alive? Because like, I had, you know, I'd been following all of the tension, the suspense, the mystery. I had been like, doing the sort of whodunit, which one is it? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and even like following through when it's like, maybe it's that guy. It's like, oh, there's an evil twin from the mental institution. I was like, oh, okay, that's kind of interesting. Maybe a little boring, but interesting. As it got through, when it was just like, JK, I was genuinely a little mad.
I really liked it, but I also don't know that I accepted it until the credits started rolling. Like, once that happened, I was like, okay, they're alive, but are they? You know?
Yeah.
I was waiting for another layer to it.
I was suspicious. Suspicious with a growing resentment.
I saw it. I was just kind of like, oh, this is what you did. I was kind of like, oh. And I mean, I don't know. I was rather pleased that that was the case, because I hadn't entirely seen it coming.
Yeah.
And that was just, that's where I thought, okay, this movie was more clever than I was giving it credit for, given like when it was from and what they were doing. So, and it's probably the only time I can think of where I've seen a good, like, hey, we're a big group of your friends and we gotcha. In that respect, there's a movie, and I'm trying to look it up as we're talking. The singer Pink was in a horror movie where the same sort of thing took place, and it was done very poorly at the end, and all the friends got killed.
Oh,
like,
no.
Like, the person who was pranked was like, oh, I don't think so. So this is the only time I can think of in all the horror movies I've watched where I've been like, okay, this worked out well in the grand scheme of things. Mm.
There was a tiny piece of me that was disappointed just because I loved Buffy so much. The idea of that character, although I was happy that in the end it wasn't a crazy woman who escaped an asylum, you know?
Right. Like, that's pretty cheesy. And then, yeah, in the end, definitely afterward, I did come around to be like, all right, that was pretty clever. Pretty clever to like prank all of us. Coming into it.
So the look on Kit's face as she turns around and sees that it was a fake knife, because Muffy does the thing where she like squishes the knife together, is priceless. And she's like, really funny, you guys.
Yeah, like, also again, a very mild reaction to Weekend of Terror, just like, oh, you guys.
And poor Rob is still in the closet thinking she's getting slaughtered. And he's like,
I thought he was going to die. Like, I thought he was going to die while this was happening, while they were all like,
that would have been a good twist.
Yes.
Or he was going to get out and kill Muffy or something before anyone could say anything.
Well, and that's the part I found probably the second funniest part of the movie, where he's banging on the closet door. He's like, I love you, kid. And he's yelling it, but I'm thinking, do you not hear all your friends cheering? Like, they're not quiet.
Yeah. So, and he's like, not far. Like, it's not like he's at the other end of the house.
It's just it. So I'm like, dude, like, you're not yelling louder than they are. I know you must hear them in your hysteria. So.
And how Buck gets in the closet with him, like, and is like, I love you too, man. And then takes off his, like, prosthetic injury and slaps it on his face.
So he's been wearing it the whole time? That's the other thing.
When it was revealed that, you know, everything was a prank, I did sort of look back on the purposely bad makeup, which made me question a lot of things. Because again, sort of like earlier when it was, is that, oh, I guess it's just bad writing, you know, things that don't make sense. You're just like, that's bad writing. But then in the context of the movie, the things that don't make sense is because the whole thing was a prank. And so even the makeup, you know, and I definitely remember, like, you know, when the eye coming off, or, you know, the first dead body, I was like, oh, this is pretty like 80s low budget makeup. Like, this is not that convincing. But because I know I'm watching a 80s slasher, I'm accepting that. So it's sort of an odd thing to think also, like, that was on purpose, but then in the sort of context of the movie, from the viewpoint of the characters, they had to believe that this bad makeup was real. I got really turned around by the whole idea of that.
The filmmakers thought that they were making something super realistic at the time, and it just aged well because of the premise of the movie. If they on purpose sort of made it a little silly.
I would wonder if, given how scared in air quotes they must be at that point, seeing those various instances of bad makeup and Muffy's fake decapitated head, how much of your brain doesn't register?
It's a good point.
I don't know. I'm purely guessing here. I wonder, like, if I'm on the dock, and for a hot second, I see Buck's mangled face. Do I stop and really scrutinize it? Or do I like look away? I don't know.
Yeah, that's very fair, Ryan. I'm like, not sure. And then I had a second of thinking, I was like, well, I guess in this universe, dead bodies are caked in blue, you know, like a sort of pale blue. Yeah, I mean, like in this universe, the sort of like the physiology of bodies in this world is that this is what dead bodies look like. So no one is surprised by it, or no one questions it specifically. No one questions that it might not be real.
I would like to think, and this is just me being hopeful, that if I saw someone's face get mangled at a dock, that I would take an extra second to look at it. Like, wow, you know, that looks really realistic.
Yeah, maybe you will now. I'm gonna
hang around some docks.
I hope none of the characters from this movie are ever involved in an actual murder, because they're not gonna believe anything.
That's true. Right?
They'll be like, "Where's the
boy
Muffy?
Who cried wolf?"
Muffy, is that you?
Yeah.
We now learn Muffy's whole plan. She can only get the house that she's set to inherit next month if she can show her father that it can basically support itself. So she came up with the idea to make it an inn, complete with a whodunit once in a lifetime weekend, but she needed a rehearsal. So she came up with this big plan. Skip is actually Muffy's brother, so there is a real twin. It's just not Buffy, it's Skip. Buck is a makeup artist. The constable is her uncle. Mm-hmm. And the ferryman, they were all in on it. She apologizes that some of the fake clues were taken too seriously. Are you kidding me? Of course they were taken seriously.
They were very, like, specific to each person.
Heroin addiction, abortion, deadly car crashes. Why would you take those seriously? Everyone seems okay with it, though, as they all drink, they get rowdy, and the night eventually comes to an end. Like, they're like drinking, like they're giving the decapitated heads alcohol. It's
very funny. Another very, very hilarious scene when they're pouring the drink down the...
Rarely would I use the phrase champagne soaked, but like literally they're just dousing Muffy in half full bottles of cheap champagne. I'm like, you have this beautiful house and you're getting champagne all over the floors. Who's mopping this up? Like, this is the way that my brain works with some of these things. But I got to throw in Deborah Foreman. Mm-hmm. Actually, I thought this was one of her best scenes in the movie, not getting doused with the champagne. But before that, when she's explaining it, that seemed really natural. Like, that seemed like, as ridiculous as the movie was, a plausible explanation. And the way she delivers it, I'm just like, I remember thinking the second or third time around, like, wow, she's a really good actress. Like, she's really selling it. Mm-hmm. That's just me. But yeah, it was just the champagne on the floor. Dad's gonna be pissed. Dad's gonna be so pissed.
Like, also, it doesn't quite make sense, because if you're opening an inn with a whodunit weekend, all your guests are gonna know going in. But that's
otherwise you're going to get,
like,
sued.
Why wouldn't you tell your friends that this test run for this?
Yeah.
And you know, then maybe it goes off the rails somehow. But
yeah, there was an interesting over explanation of why all of this was happening. Like, they could have just, they didn't even need the other subplot of, like, I'm opening a weekend getaway inn with a whodunit factor to it. It could have just been like, I love pranking my friends.
I was traumatized by a Jack in the Box when I was a kid, and now I do this to feel something.
I like the whodunit, but I mean, it doesn't make sense. It's not like you go to a murder mystery and, like, they don't tell you that that's what you're going to. Like,
right.
If I was just going to dinner, I would not go back to that restaurant.
No, ever, ever. So Muffy retires to her bedroom. The noose is still hanging from the ceiling, and there's a present on her bed. Oh. So she goes to find another Jack in the Box. She starts to turn the handle before she puts it back down, but she can't resist. So she picks it back up. And just as it pops back open, Nan pops up behind her and cuts her throat. Oh, just kidding. April Fools.
I like the little extra scene there, because it got me again.
Especially because Nan's the crying baby thing was, like, cruel and terrible.
Yeah. Yes, it was.
She should have gotten her back.
But I also feel like it shows that Nan was, like, acting, like, I feel like maybe Nan knew the whole time what was happening. I don't know.
Oh, maybe.
Because she was acting a very different, she seemed very different than when she shows up at the end with her, like, sexy slicked back hair and, like,
she's
much more, like, extroverted and, like, I don't know. That's,
oh, that's interesting. Maybe the whole movie was, like, an extended acting project for her.
Maybe.
It's possible. I mean, and then you have the Jack of the Box winking at the very end, like, hey, Nan's in on it too.
Yeah.
Everybody's getting down.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's basically the end of the movie. There's the very jaunty, sounds very vintagey song, Too Bad You're Crazy, over the credits. But that, yeah, that's it. Mm-hmm. Now, there were two alternate endings. So one was actually filmed. The guests leave, except for Rob, Kit, Chaz, and Nikki. They sneak back to the house to prank Muffy as revenge. But when they return, Skip basically has some kind of like psychotic break and attempts to kill Muffy. Rob jumps in, saves her, and kills Skip in the process. So the studio didn't like it. They wanted a more upbeat conclusion, but there is a novelization of the movie, and this is exactly how the book ends. There was another one that was scripted in which Muffy, again, believes she's left alone on the island. Skip cuts her throat. She screams, only to have the rest of the characters thought to be gone, enter the room laughing because they pranked her back, kind of thing at the end where she gets pranked. But I think that the ending they went with is probably the best.
Yeah, I agree. I do think that this ending is the best of it, because I did try to play in my brain sort of like, what if you know, it was like a prank, but then actually someone did die, you know, like how that would have changed the whole thing. And even though I was mad to be pranked, I did feel in the end that it was like very clever, very successful, you know. And I like, Sherry, you mentioned at the beginning how like you had always seen this cover at the video store. Mm-hmm. And I also remember like, you know, going to the video store and like perusing the horror section and always seeing this. And it was such an enticing cover. Mm-hmm. And I never ended up renting it, but I always was like, ooh, I was like, ooh, someday I'm gonna get that. I'm gonna watch that. It was always, and I never knew the ending. It was never spoiled for me. So watching it for the first time, like, I'm really thankful that somehow, and you know, when it was at 30 years ago, that like it did not get spoiled for me, and I got to have a genuine reaction to it. But it is fun to have a horror movie where nobody dies.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was a really cool feeling to be like at the end, like, I just watched this slasher movie but no one is dead and there was no slasher.
Like, it was all fake.
A cool thing.
Okay, so Robin and Tuya, you said you have seen the remake. So what are your thoughts on the remake?
I really liked the remake.
Wow. So I was just saying, so the second ending that you described is kind of similar to the ending of the remake.
Yes.
Yeah,
without spoiling it too much. I mean, it definitely it is a little bit bigger of a story. It's a little more expansive. It happens over the course of a year. It came out in 2008, but it's set in, it starts in 2007. But let me tell you, it is a very mid-aughts looking movie. I'm sure, Robin, you can agree with that.
Oh man, they're like silky prom dresses. It's also not quite the same premise. It's instead of like a group of friends on an island for a week, it's like a group of rich like debutantes who
are planning a ball at the beginning. And so
the other thing that I found crazy about it is that there were like in the original version there were a couple like kind of like homophobic moments and whatever. This one, the 2008 one, was by far more offensive.
Really?
Some of the words that they used, oh my god.
No. Oh, absolutely. It felt like, and you know, I think that I think me and Robin say this a lot, when a movie comes out in 2008, we're like, wow, that's very 2008, because it was just, you know, like a little brash in a way that was like very accepted for sort of like fictional young people to talk. And it definitely, you know, was a very glossy kind of like teen drama mystery, you know, where it was sort of like young people in this like high society setting, but I think they were all wearing prom dresses, which really threw me off.
It also looked like the set of like a high school play.
It absolutely looked like the set of a high school play. It is definitely direct to video.
It was direct to video. It felt like a combination between an episode of Gilmore Girls and like a Lifetime movie.
Oh, I am sold now, Robin. I am sold.
I recommend it.
I recommend it too. It's bad CW enough, era.
A very specific way that in which no other movie is bad.
It is, because it's bad, but it's so fun to watch because it's real right. bad.
But also plot-wise, it's very different. Like, all the characters are different.
Hmm.
Yeah.
You know, there's sort of like the one jokester who's always filming things.
Right.
Yeah. You know, the rich kind of ringleader. But it is like, it is plot-wise pretty different.
Yes, yes. Than the original. And I like the twist at the end. I mean, you know, this isn't going to spoil it, but there's definitely a twist at the end, something that you may or may not be expecting, because it does veer so far off from the original, in that sense that I thought it was very fun, but it did feel, like you said, Robin, and like we've been saying, sort of, yeah, that sort of glossy CW kind of Gossip Girl like mystery. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, not quite very Veronica much. Mars, but a yeah. really like a really like young person mystery with right. like, you know, generically good looking people in the 2000s with like little Bobby, those little like flower Bobby.
Oh yes, hair. yeah
no, the fashions are excellent.
All right, I'm gonna check it out. Did you know that there was a script for a sequel?
No. What?
So in a reunion screening panel, Nikki, the actress that played Nikki, said that she was sent a script and she was not quite clear on the details, couldn't remember the names of the two writers, but basically what happened was Chaz and Nikki had gotten married. They bought a closed down porno theater on 42nd Street in New York City, right? That they wanted to turn into a bed and breakfast.
What? Everyone's trying to open inns.
Right? One of Chaz's college aged relatives arrives for a visit. The games begin again.
Interesting. Can you prank me a second time? I wonder.
I feel like you would be able to.
Right? It's hard. Right? Yeah, because I think the problem with this movie is that, not that you couldn't watch it again, but it's a movie where that thrill is only captured the first time.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that like other horror movies, you can keep feeling the thrill of other horror movies, but this one is like, okay, once mm-hmm. once you know the ending, once that's spoiled, it's hard to, now you're watching it for other reasons.
Yeah, I think this time when you watch it a second time, you're looking more for clues as to the twist. You're trying to like find right. things that substantiate that in the long run, right?
Yeah.
And while sometimes that works, like for multiple views, like if you watch something like The Sixth Sense, you can watch that over and over and over again because it's a great movie. And even when you figured out all those clues that lead to the twist, it still doesn't take away from the overall movie. Right. I feel like April Fool's Day is not a movie you're watching four or five times, like, or every year on April Fool's Day. I mean, I don't know. So
it would be fun to show to people.
It would right. be fun to show to
right?
people. Yeah. For the first time.
Yeah.
Part of me would want to watch that sequel though. Only yeah. because the amount yeah. of money it would cost just to open up anything on 42nd Street. Like, there's the prank right there. Oh, I'm going to open up. Wait, how much does it cost? Oh, forget it.
Yeah.
Like, that's insane.
I like the maybe this new horror subgenre of like, I'm just trying to open an inn.
Yeah. anything else that stood out for you in the movie?
I like that none of the deaths happen on screen. Mm-hmm. I thought that was interesting, especially as like a slasher movie, but it also, I think, was stylistically the right choice because it made sense. Because at the time when I was watching it, I was like, oh, we're never seeing anyone actually get killed. Mm-hmm. We're just seeing the bodies afterwards. Like, where's my blood and guts and gore? But then it makes sense, obviously, now afterwards. I'm like, oh yeah, I guess they didn't. Not a single on-screen death.
I'd have to say, having now gone back and watched this, it's got that sort of that Fight Club sort of thing going on, where once you've seen Fight Club and then you realize the twist at the end and you go back and watch it again and you pick up on all the things that you missed because you didn't, you know what I mean? So like mm-hmm. watching April Fool's Day again and going, oh, there's the foreshadowing. Oh, there's the hint of this happening and so on and so forth. I think that lent it. I think so April Fool's Day, again, the original, not the reboot, since I haven't seen it, I can't speak to it, but is a movie you could, in theory, watch twice if you really wanted to. You could get you could get two Aprils out of it, you know,
yeah.
two years worth of fun for that $5.99 DVD. And I don't know. I dug it. I had purchased this because I enjoyed it so much when I first watched it streaming. I thought it was kind of a kick, and it was, and like, to you, like I said, and like no one dies on screen. It's a nice change of pace. I'd argue it's one of the few movies that wasn't a horror comedy or comedy horror that was fun. I don't often call horror movies fun, but this was just fun. Stupid fun in a lot of the, you know, a lot of ways, but it was fun.
I think you're right though, but the, like, picking up on the little things. So one of my favorite things that I didn't notice the first time I watched it, but I kind of clued in the second time, was when Muffy is going out to that little house. She's got a basket and you're like, what's she doing out there? Like she's taking food to the people that are hiding because they're supposed to be dead.
Yep.
So that's why she's taking the little basket of food out to them. And like, it's just very like, there's these little things. And even like, she wears red nail polish all through the whole movie. And even when she's supposed to be Buffy, she's still wearing the red nail polish. So there's these little clues all throughout, but it's just, it's so well done and they're so subtle. Well, maybe not well done, but the reveal is well done, I would say. Like, it's not yes. something that you see coming, I think, but.
No, totally. This was something that I didn't notice at first, but I read this on another site when I was just doing some research on it, but Muffy doesn't apologize at the end. Like when she is, you know, when the big reveal and she's talking to the whole thing and she doesn't actually say, hey, I'm sorry for putting you guys through all of this trauma. She never apologizes. She just rolls on like, hey, I'm trying to open an inn.
Let's have some champagne.
I thought there was something about that. I was like, oh, that's pretty interesting. What a strange character. Like, what an odd character in the best way.
What she said, doesn't she say like, but didn't we have fun?
Yeah.
She's very presumptuous. You had fun, didn't you?
Right.
And
they all did. They all had champagne afterwards. Like, no one was like, oh God, this is really going to fuck me up for a while. Like, no one, like, I thought I saw a dead body, but I didn't. And it's just my friends. Like, that is such, that's honestly a little traumatic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, later on, but everyone seems very okay with it. So I guess I'm okay with it too.
I mean, it was the 80s. Mental health wasn't as important. I mean, like, so body count was zero.
Yep.
Because all the kills were actually fake. So how many, if you had to rate this on a scale of 1 to 5, we call them the scaredy cat screams. How many scaredy cat screams would you give it?
Is this based on how scary or how much I liked it?
How much you liked it.
I'm gonna give this a 3.5 scaredy cats.
I'm gonna give it a solid 4. I enjoyed it. It was fun. I will say that the remake gets a 0.5.
But you should still watch it.
I was gonna say you told me to watch it.
Definitely watch it. It's not gonna be like enjoyable in the sense that you want movies to be enjoyable, you know. Enjoyable to like hate watch, basically.
I gotta go with 3. Like, for what it is, it's like I said, it's fun. Would I consider it the epitome of a great horror movie? No, but it was fun. So I would just say 3.
Excellent. Well, it was a pleasure talking with the three of you about this movie. Thanks for coming on today. I really appreciate it. So now is your opportunity to plug your social media, current projects, any episodes that you have coming up.
Well, thank you so much for having us. This was so much fun. I love talking about horror movies with people. My name again is Tuyet Wen. You can find me on Twitter at Tuyet Wen or on Instagram at The Tuyet Wen. But more importantly, you should listen to my podcast that I do with my friend Robin.
It's a lot of fun.
Oh, horror movie podcast. You can find us on Instagram at Bunk237Pod or on Twitter at Bunk237.
Yeah, this was so fun. Thank you so much, Sherry. I will add on to that and say you can find us anywhere you listen to podcasts at Bunk237. You can find me on Twitter at Robin Zlotnick and on Instagram also at Robin Zlotnick. And our next episode we'll talk about Basket Case.
Tuesday. I love Basket Case.
It's a good one.
Robin's dad is our guest.
Because we have history of watching some real weird movies together. So definitely check that out.
Cool. I'm stoked to hear that, actually. That is, I will admit, I have not seen Basket Case.
Oh,
it's on my
highly
list.
Recommend.
It's on my list.
Deeply it recommend. Is.
It's
you're gonna love it.
It's mm-hmm. on my. I may wait until after I hear your podcast first. So,
well,
so,
we do spoil it. So
yeah. I don't care. That's fine. I basically know what's going on. I'm not really,
right. There's not a whole gonna, lot. You're not gonna spoil it.
Yeah.
So my name is Ryan Shepherd. Like what we've said, I run the Instagram account Social Distance Horror Club, where I go through streaming movie services and find hopefully the good stuff and a couple of absolute duds to save folks the effort in case they're not that up to date on horror movies. You can also find me on Instagram at that Ryan Shepherd, which is primarily dogs and political sentiment. I have a couple of books of poetry on Amazon that were pieces of work that I was doing for my graduate degree that no one's got to buy them, but they're there. And that's pretty much it. I thank you so much for having me. I have enjoyed spending time with the three of you. This has been a riot. Really
same.
Loved it.
Absolutely. Hey, yes.
This is great.
Yeah. Ryan, tell us one dud that you found that you would actually recommend. Like maybe something that's not a great horror movie, but something that you're like, this is a good, it's a fun bad movie to watch.
A fun, oh, I got one. Oh, so there's a movie. Okay, so there's a movie that came out, and I think it only came out last year, and it's called Bullets of Justice. And if I'm not mistaken, it should still be on Prime Video streaming. And the way it's marketed, you'd think that Danny Trejo of Machete is all through it. He's in it for maybe a collected 4 minutes. If you're familiar with Tommy Wiseau's The Room, where he does everything, producing, directing, so on, I think the guy who stars in this, it's the same sort of setup. He's Russian. I think it was filmed primarily in parts of Russia that you shouldn't be walking around in because of health reasons. It's like, it looks like there's like a whole bombed out set at the very beginning of the movie. And you're like, I'm like, wow, that's a crazy model. It's got to be, because there's no way there's a part of the world that looks like that. But there's a part of the world that looks like this is not a studio set because they didn't have the money for CGI to fake this. Because it's also somewhat, it's like mid-budget, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, during World War III, the Americans and the Russians fought, and one of them, I think it was the Americans, but the plot's not clear. That's a recurring theme of the plot not being clear. One of them created a hybrid of pig people. And now the pig people outnumber the humans and harvest the humans for meat. And apparently there is a queen pig that keeps giving birth to the pig people.
Robin's nodding like she's
honestly,
like, I want to see
you
this.
Had me at pig people.
Oh, it gets better. Yeah. It gets
you
better.
You had me at that title, honestly. I was. Yeah.
Well, that's at the end. Yeah. Well, here's the half the folks in this movie, and this is not me making fun in any way, because this is not even my quote. I'm paraphrasing. Some of the folks in the film, people believe, are Russian actors and actresses who are only repeating dialogue phonetically because they don't seem to understand what they're saying.
Oh.
And you can pick them out. It doesn't take long before you're like, there's one of them. It's hilarious.
Oh,
it's
man.
Horror in the sense that, like, it's not slapstick like Tucker and Dale versus Evil, but because they take it too seriously. But at the same time, they don't take it too seriously. Like, it's campy. It's amazing. And I kept watching it going, what the hell am I watching? This is great. Because, like, it's just nonstop bananas. People doing flips out of windows and landing in their Jeep and driving away. Pig men are getting shot right in the face. There is plenty of gratuitous sex, and I'm talking like borderline, I'm amazed they got this on Prime Video type stuff. Like,
wow.
You're like, wait a minute, did that just flash what I saw? So it's not one to share with the youngins, but it's entertaining. It's definitely that.
Okay.
So that would be, I've seen just bad movies that I wouldn't share, and frankly, none are coming to mind, but Bullets of Justice.
If I could
buy it, I would buy it just for this, like in the same way that I bought The Room for my collection.
Yes.
Not for horror, but just because The Room, I think, is
hilariously
bad. The Room
is an incredible movie. Yes.
It's like that. It's hilariously bad in that same way.
Yeah. I'm going to say, when you told me that the title was Bullets of Justice, I did not expect that to be about pig people.
No, not at all.
And I expected more Danny Trejo, and there's practically none.
Yeah, so that sounds very, very fun.
That does sound fun.
It was.
Awesome. Thank you for that recommendation.
Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us today. You can catch us on Twitter at @CatScaredy and on Instagram at @ScaredyCats the podcast. Subscribe wherever you find podcasts, and don't forget to let us know what you think by leaving us a review. Until next time, stay scared.